The Democratic candidates in Wisconsin's governor's race met for their only televised debate last night as they make a play for undecided voters. It's Wednesday, July 29th. This is Wisconsin Today Morning News. Good morning. I'm Courtney Everett. Coming up, residents of Menasha in the Fox Valley are confronting the devastation left behind when a powerful tornado struck the community this week. And many farmers are worried whether they'll see a profit this year thanks to the high cost of supplies like fertilizer and diesel.
Sitting here today, our crop doesn't appear to be as good as last year.
Stay with us.
Support for WPR comes from the state of Wisconsin, business sponsors, and tens of thousands of supporters who contribute. Thank you to everyone who makes WPR possible on air, on the app, and at WPR.org.
During the only televised debate ahead of the primary, the five remaining Democrats in the race for governor found a lot of common ground last night. Rich Kramer reports all of them want to raise taxes on Wisconsin millionaires.
The debate hosted by WISN 12 ran through a bevy of topics like tax policy. One by one, Francesca Hong, Mandela Barnes, Joel Brennan, David Crowley, and Kelda Royce said they'd like to see income taxes go up for people making more than $1 million. Hong said she'd raise taxes on millionaires from about 7.6 to 8.6%.
We need to return to a progressive income tax rate. It is how we build sustainable revenue.
She did not mention a bill she co-sponsored in the legislature that would create a new 17% tax bracket for millionaires. Brennan also said millionaires should pay a higher rate, but warned Democrats can't just focus on tax increases.
If it's just going to be penalties, then we are going to start to lose. We need to make sure we're growing with everybody.
Tuesday's debate comes 2 weeks ahead of the August primary election. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Cleanup efforts are underway in the Appleton area after a tornado ripped through the region on Monday. As Joe Schultz reports, the storm caused catastrophic damage to dozens of homes and businesses in the city of Menasha.
As Gary Liebhauser looked at his damaged home in Menasha, he said the day after a devastating tornado hit the community was even harder than the day of.
Yesterday it was just, okay, just deal with it. Today you wake up and it's still here.
Liebhauser lives in a neighborhood that was especially hard hit, near Plank Road in Manderfield's Bakery. He isn't the only one picking up the pieces. Menasha Mayor Austin Hammond says the recovery won't happen overnight.
This community has always been at its best when neighbors help neighbors, and I have no doubt that that spirit will carry us through the days ahead.
Governor Tony Evers has declared a state of emergency for the region. No storm-related fatalities were reported as of Tuesday afternoon. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The tornado that caused widespread damage in the Menasha area is the fourth severe tornado to hit Wisconsin so far this year. The Twister was classified as an EF3 with estimated high winds of around 140 miles per hour. It's already the fourth tornado of that level that has touched down in the state this year. Before this year, the last EF3 that hit Wisconsin was back in 2021. Timothy Hallback is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service Milwaukee Sullivan office.
The air masses that we've had this year have been more humid, and the winds aloft have been better as well to be able to create these severe level storms.
There's been 43 tornadoes in Wisconsin so far this year. That's tied for the fourth highest number since storm data began being collected in the 1950s. Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin sent a letter yesterday demanding answers from the Trump administration about long delays cleaning up PFAS at military sites. Daniel Kading has more.
In Wisconsin, cleanup milestones at Truax Field in Madison and Volk Field near Camp Douglas have been pushed out 14 to 15 years. Senator Tammy Baldwin sent a letter to Air Force Secretary Troy Manck about what the revised timelines mean for addressing PFAS at military sites. The letter comes after defense officials delayed deadlines for investigating PFAS by up to 20 years at nearly 200 sites nationwide. At Truax Field, groundwater sampling has found PFAS levels tens of thousands times higher than state and federal drinking water limits. One of Madison's wells near the base was shut down in 2019 after a groundwater study confirmed it may be the source of PFAS contamination. The well was brought back online last year after installation of a treatment system. An Air Force spokesperson said the secretary will respond to the senator's letter. Danielle Kadang, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The majority of U.S. corn and soybean fields are in good condition this summer, but many farmers are worried whether they'll see a profit this year thanks to the high cost of supplies like fertilizer and diesel. As WPR's Hope Kerman reports for Harvest Public Media, the widespread economic stress throughout farm country is drawing some comparisons to the farm crisis of the 1980s.
In southern Wisconsin, not far from the Illinois border, rows of green corn blanket Pat Malooly's family farm. The sixth-generation grower has had strong yields for both corn and soybeans during the past 2 years. Those abundant harvests have helped make up for low crop prices since 2024. But Malooly worries he won't have that to fall back on this year.
Sitting here today, our crop doesn't appear to be as good as last year.
He's hoping there will be enough at the end of the season to at least cover what he's had to spend to grow the crop. Profit margins for both corn and soybeans have been negative for the past 2 years, according to data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This year's cost of production is projected to be even higher, thanks to the war in Iran driving up the price of fertilizer and fuel. It's far from the first tough financial time Malooly's family has had to navigate. More than four decades ago, farmers faced another period of negative margins. By the end of the 1980s farm crisis, an estimated 300,000 farmers had defaulted on their loans. Malooly was a teenager at the time. He says it wasn't until much later that he understood how much his parents struggled to manage their debt and keep farming.
Horror stories of them not even getting the interest paid, you know, and putting that back on the debt. So it was very tough times back then.
The current struggle for row crop farmers to make a profit feels akin to the 80s. But ag economist Seth Meyer from the University of Missouri says that's where the comparison ends.
I think you just have a different system involved now than you used to have.
In the 80s, growers were forced to sell their farms in order to pay off debts. But Meyer, who was previously USDA's chief economist, says a landslide of foreclosures is unlikely to happen today, thanks to federal safety net programs. More producers use crop insurance, as well as government programs designed to offer financial support when crop prices fall.
I'd also say we've got a government that seems willing to inject a lot of money into the system.
Meyer says one-time aid payments, like the Trump administration's $12 billion assistance program, can help farms pay down their debts and survive until crop prices recover. But he says the influx of cash may also be keeping prices for farm supplies high. At the same time, interest rates have increased from the lows seen during the COVID-19 pandemic. They're still well below the roughly 20% charged by banks in the early 80s.
There weren't long-term fixed interest rates at that time.
Joe Springer is managing director of ag lending for Compeer Financial, working with farms in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And he says most farms are not carrying as much debt.
We're coming off a record years where our row crop producers made more money than maybe they ever had in their careers in the early 2020s here. And so that's different than what happened as we were going through the 80s.
But the profits from 2021 and 2022 are starting to run out. And Springer says farmers will need to think about how they're going to manage more volatility in markets in the coming years. Meyer says the impact of the current downturn will also depend on how much longer crop prices stay depressed.
Does this continue on for several years? In which case, you've already got folks that are trying to get themselves to next year.
In Wisconsin, Malooly is also thinking about next summer, despite months of work ahead to get to this year's harvest. He's already looking to lock in prices for some supplies, with the hope of guarding against future increases.
Everything we do is managing risk, and there's a cost to that.
He might end up paying too much if the cost of fuel or fertilizer comes down, and it's hard to predict what will happen to crop prices before next season. I'm Hope Kerwin, Harvest Public Media.
This story is the first in Tough Times, a Harvest Public Media series, looking at the economic stress that many American farmers are facing this year. Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including WPR. Coming up after the break, we'll hear about one Wisconsin resident's love of a very specific kind of car culture. Stay with us.
The headlines might change and change again and again, but our commitment to the facts won't budge.
Did he give any evidence that this agency, as he said, is run by radical lunatics?
Let me just understand something here. So the White House wants universities to monitor students. Let's try to get the facts out. What is driving this?
Stay focused and informed with Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Wisconsinite and his love of cars.
Summertime in Milwaukee is more than beer gardens and beach parties. It's also cruising season, where people bring out their favorite cars. Eric Ramos from the south side of Milwaukee has grown up in the culture, specifically the lowrider culture. As Jimmy Gutierrez tells us, Ramos is helping that scene grow.
60 Impala, 80 DeVille, Cadillac. It's the baddest Cadillac in the south side.
This is Eric Ramos.
Three-wheel king. The black and gold don't fold.
He's pointing out a few lowrider favorites at the World of Wheels, Milwaukee's first car show of the year. For this show, Eric brought out his baby, as he calls it. It's his 35 Packard. Think any Prohibition-era gangster movie. It's got an oversized chrome grille, wave-like side panels, and a velvety navy blue paint job. Altogether, there are 20 to 25 lowriders here today. And that number, like Milwaukee's lowrider scene, is growing.
The lowrider scene, I think, is badass. In the last 15 years, easily, it's changed.
While lowriders are having a moment in Milwaukee, Ramos says a lot of that scene today can be traced back to one club in the early 90s.
Bajitos. You had Bajitos shop right there on 6th and Orchard.
Ramos grew up down the block and remembers there wasn't much else at the time.
But as we grew up, I think it was our generation that blew it up.
Another major change at that time was the introduction of Lowrider magazine. It was the Vogue or GQ for street culture, featuring the baddest rides from coast to coast. And at the end of each printing was an ad section where riders in places like Milwaukee could finally find parts they've been searching for. The problem wasn't where to find the parts, but how much to spend on them.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hundreds of thousands from buying cars, parts, adding to them. I mean, you get a car, what do you do? Rims, radio, hydraulics.
Car culture has been a family affair for Ramos. Uncles, cousins, friends got him hooked. And his parents hoped that it would keep him out of trouble.
They knew, like, this little f***er's gonna, you know, we gotta make sure we keep him busy.
They tried. But besides being drawn to cars, Ramos was also drawn to the streets.
I mean, why sugarcoat it? Yeah, I was a gangbanger. I was a drug dealer. I was a criminal.
After prison, he retired from gangbanging in the early 2000s. He knows that not everyone can walk away as easily as he did. And that's when he dove headfirst into the lowrider scene. It didn't take long for other riders to invite him out to car shows or to just go cruising. Exactly what he needed.
You know, these guys are not dealing. These guys are not gangbanging. These just, you know, some of these guys already have families.
Ramos ended up joining a car club, and it brought a lot of things he was familiar with in gang life, camaraderie, structures, but also some bad politics. So after a while, he and a group of guys branched off and started their own club in Milwaukee, Ranflitas.
They used to say the Ranfla. So the homies back then, the Zoot Suiters or whatever, you know, here comes the ride. In reality, that's what it means, the ride.
While the Milwaukee chapter is modest, 5 to 7 riders, it's a nationwide club. And their impact in Milwaukee is as large as a G-body. They've organized neighborhood cleanups, food and coat drives, picnics, and changed the narrative of who's behind the wheel. Ranflitas has also started their own car show, El Grito, which turned 5 last year, and its biggest event yet.
We've seen that 5th Street was getting gentrified. 5th Street was all restaurants, tortillerias. It was a Latino thing, you know what I mean? It was all raza businesses there. And we started seeing the changes, like, man, we gotta do something just to let the newcomers know where they're at. Not being asked, but you know what I mean? Keep the tradition. Let it be known, like, hey, okay, to you guys, it's new, but we've been here.
Thousands of people took over South 5th Street in Walker's Point. There was music, vendors, traditional Aztec dancers, all just a block away from where it all started in Milwaukee. And that's what this is all about. keeping the culture growing and thriving.
Jimmy Gutierrez is a reporter based in Milwaukee. He brought us that story on Eric Ramos and the lowriders of the city. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now let's get to weather. A heat advisory will go into effect from noon to 7 p.m., and that will impact Burnett, Washburn, Sawyer, Ashland, Bayfield, and Douglas counties. The heat index could reach the mid-90s. Highs, meanwhile, statewide expected to reach the low 80s. Lots of sunshine and warm today, and isolated showers are possible in the afternoon in central and the northern parts. Tonight, a few clouds and mild, with lows mainly in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, partly sunny, very warm and humid, and a small chance of afternoon showers over the northern half in the later afternoon. Highs will reach 85 to 90 degrees statewide. And that's all for Wisconsin Today Morning News on this Wednesday. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. A special shout out to our producer today, Rob Benser. We'll see you back here tomorrow for more news. Yeah.